Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Beating the Heat, Preparing for Extreme Heat Events at the State and Local Levels webinar. During the presentation, participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you would like to ask a question during the presentation, please make use of the chat feature, which is located in the lower left corner of your screen. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star zero on your telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, May 23rd, 2013. I would now like to turn the conference over to APHA. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for attending. Today's webinar is co-sponsored by the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health and Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry and the American Public Health Association. This is APHA's first webinar for 2013 on extreme summer weather events and a continuation of last summer's drought webinar series. Our follow-up webinar later this summer will be covering drought. Thank you again for attending. I'll now turn you over to our moderator, Elizabeth Martin Pereira. Ms. Martin Pereira is the senior Washington representative for the Sierra Club and chair of the Climate and Health Topics Committee of APHA's Environment Section.
Thank you, Angela. This is Liz Pereira, and welcome to all of you. I'm honored to be here today with the APHA and CDC and our presenters from New York and Minnesota. APHA works to build understanding and awareness of the public health implications of climate change. Strong climate change strategies and interventions that protect people's health are greatly needed, and the public health community plays a critical role. We at APHA have a long history of working at the intersection of climate change and public health, and are a partner and a strong supporter of CDC's Climate and Health Program. I am also chair of the Climate and Health Topic Committee, which is part of our Environment Section at APHA. We're an active group of 100 public health professionals interested in the intersection of climate change and public health, and I work on climate change policy and impacts with the Sierra Club. I also wrote a series of reports on climate change and health with the Union of Concerned Scientists on increased ozone levels, extreme storms, and most recently, heat waves. Our report on heat waves entitled Heat in the Heartland was a retrospective report of 60 years of data from five Midwestern cities. We found statistically significant increases in the length and duration of heat waves, as well as a trend towards more humid nighttime temperatures. The webinar today will review available extreme heat resources and highlight work already being done at the state and local level to prepare us for extreme heat events. I'm thrilled now to introduce Dr. George Luber. Dr. George Luber is an Associate Director for Climate Change Division of Environmental Hazards and Health Effects at the National Center for Environmental Health and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry at CDC. He's an epidemiologist, and he received his PhD in medical anthropology from the University of Georgia. He joined CDC in 2002. Dr. Luber has served as an epidemic intelligence service officer and staff epidemiologist at the National Center for Environmental Health. His research interests in environmental health are broad and include health impacts of environmental change, biodiversity loss, harmful algal blooms, and health effects of climate change. In addition to managing the climate change program at CDC, Dr. Luber is co-chair of the Climate Change and Health Interagency Working Group at the U.S. Global Change Research Program, a convening lead author and member of the Federal Advisory Committee for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, a member of the American Anthropological Association Presidential Task Force on Climate Change, and a lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Fifth Assessment Report. Dr. Luber.
Thanks, Liz, and just want to reiterate thanks again for all your support, both at UCS and now at the Sierra Club, for your and all your tireless activity on climate change. It really has made a difference, and I'm certain as you now take over the head of APHA's Climate Change Working Group that we have much more to come. So thank you very much. Also, thanks to Angela Dijak and Tracy Kolian for their efforts in getting this off the ground. I think this marks the 15th webinar we've had over the past couple of years around climate change and extreme weather, and I hope this serves as a valuable resource for you out there. I'm only going to talk for a few minutes just to summarize some of the tools that we have, because we have an excellent lineup of speakers today that have some really innovative and interesting work underway that I think you will find stimulating. The purpose of my few minutes here today is to describe the various resources that we have available at CDC on extreme heat, and to summarize what those are, how you might find them, and why they might be useful. The first item of interest is our brand new Extreme Heat webpage, which is intended to be a one-stop shop for all of CDC's resources on extreme heat, ranging from the resources that we've provided here at the Climate and Health Program, but also from our colleagues in NIOSH and other parts of CDC. There's the webpage, cdc.gov, Extreme Heat, and I invite you to take a look at that and learn about the various tools that we have in there. And as you dig through this site, you'll see a couple of documents. The image on the right, the Excessive Heat Events Guidebook, was a collaboration that was led by the Environmental Protection Agency with collaboration from CDC, NOAA, and FEMA on guidance on how to identify and respond to extreme heat events. This guidebook is, again, a one-stop shop of various best practices for identifying heat events, for understanding at-risk populations, and for developing heat response plans. The document on the left is a brand new guidebook that summarizes the relation between climate change and extreme heat events, and was developed, it's put out by us, but we had some strong collaboration from partners including EPA. And this, again, summarizes information about how to identify, what is the relation between climate change and extreme heat, and how to respond to it with extreme heat prevention programs. Additionally, we have materials that are designed specifically for target audiences, outdoor workers, children and school-aged children, the elderly, amongst others. We have a media toolkit, which is comprised of an array of communications materials, from posters that you see on the left. We have door hangers and labels, all the way to draft language for outreach letters to various public health professionals and affiliates, such as pharmacists and people that run programs that reach to vulnerable populations, outreach templates. These are all customizable and could serve as off-the-shelf resources for state and local health departments as they accumulate materials that they could deploy once a heat event is called, or as we are doing now in a pre-season effort to get folks to think about extreme heat and what are the resources that they need to gather. That really is the purpose of our event today, to highlight this, to show resources so that when the event happens, you are already prepared for it. And that's the intent of our drought webinar to come up in the next few weeks. Additionally, we have educational materials related to recognizing, preventing, and treating heat-related illness. This image here and the URL can be found on our new webpage is an online training course intended to enhance the ability of those working with student-athletes, coaches, athletic trainers, and parents who volunteer on the recognition on when to and how you can detect if a student-athlete is overheating, should be brought to cooler environments. This course is accredited through CDC University and is intended for a wide variety of audiences, not just coaches and parents. So I encourage you to take a look at this. It's a course that's designed around vignette-style learning. For the more technically savvy and for our epidemiologists, we have been collaborating with the National Environmental Public Health Tracking Network to develop functionality on their data portal in various aspects of evaluating extreme heat risk. One of the first steps that we took was to develop a tool that would allow localities, this is all county-level data, to assess their exposure to extreme heat by using an algorithm that the user can determine and modify various definitions of heat. The user can select whether or not they want to define a heat wave using temperature or through heat index. They can then select whether they want to set threshold values in a relative sense, the 90, 95th, and 98th percentile, or in an absolute sense, 90 degrees, 95 degrees, 98 degrees, etc. And then they can set a duration component. Once the user defines these parameters, the database produces a list of the dates on which those levels were exceeded. This provides a nice tool. It can be downloaded into a tabular format that will allow you to match this with morbidity and mortality data that you might have available. So this is think of this as a way of first identifying the exposure periods that can be matched with health outcomes. Further functionality will include health outcomes associated with these particular events. Currently, we have functionality that lets you look at monthly heat-related deaths, but not specific to any particular heat period. So please take a look at this tool and come back in the future for additional updates to this tracking portal. So that's enough of me. I want to turn it over to our first presenter. We're back to Liz to introduce Katie Ling. Thanks, all.
Thank you so much, George. That was fantastic. I will next introduce Catherine Lane. She's an epidemiologist at the Bureau of Environmental Surveillance and Policy at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, where she has been conducting analyses of the public health impacts of climate change, including rising summer temperatures and heat waves. She also coordinates the analysis of syndromic surveillance for heat-related illness. She has an MPH in epidemiology from the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and completed the CDC's CSDE Applied Epidemiology Fellowship Program. Thank you, Catherine.
Great. Thank you very much. So I'm going to talk about how we use syndromic surveillance for heat illness during the summer in New York City. And first, I just briefly want to review some of the health impacts that can result from heat exposure. As we all know, heat can take a really large public health toll. And there are two types of heat deaths: direct heat stroke, where heat is recognized as the cause of death on somebody's death certificate. And there's also something that we call excess natural cause mortality. And that happens when someone dies from another cause, for instance, cardiovascular disease, that's exacerbated by heat, but it's not recognized as a heat-related death. However, we know that this happens because epidemiologic analyses have shown that mortality rates are much higher during heat waves. There are also increases in hospital visits for heat illness, as well as for some chronic conditions like cardiovascular or respiratory disease. So heat waves cause more deaths on average every year than any other form of extreme weather events in the U.S., and there have been several notable heat waves in recent years. In 1995, there was a deadly heat wave in Chicago that killed 750 people, and another one in 2003 in Europe that killed upwards of 35,000. In 2000 in New York City, we had about 150 heat-related deaths, most of them connected to a severe 10-day heat wave. And heat-related deaths are preventable. Nobody has to die from heat exposure. So we also know that in New York City, climate change is going to lead to more frequent and more intense heat waves in the coming decades, and that could further increase the health burden from heat. In 2009, projections by the New York City Panel on Climate Change indicated that the number of heat waves would increase from 2 on average each summer to between 4 and 6 on average each year during the 2020s. So the duration of these heat waves is also expected to increase. Official heat emergencies in New York City used to be declared when the heat index reached 105 degrees, but after the deadly 2006 season, colleagues in our department went back and did a retrospective analysis to look at the relationship between temperature and excess mortality, and retrospective, of course, just means looking back at past years of data, and they found that there was considerable excess mortality when the heat index was lower than this 105-degree threshold. And also consecutive days of very hot weather increased the risk further. And as a result of this analysis, the National Weather Service in our area set new heat advisory levels in 2008. So when there are any two consecutive days predicted to hit 95 degrees or one day of 100-degree weather, New York City will declare an official heat emergency. And criteria for heat emergencies are different in other areas. when a heat emergency is declared, our Office of Emergency Management coordinates a multi-agency response with many components. But some of the activities that are meant to protect health are putting out health advisories to the public and providers, reaching out to special needs service providers in advance, opening hundreds of cooling centers across the city, enhanced outreach to homeless populations, and taking steps to protect the water and power supply. The health department also conducts syndromic surveillance of heat-related emergency department visits and emergency medical service calls during heat waves, and we study heat-related deaths after severe heat waves. The health department also conducts preseason heat health education for the public and providers, and we work to promote the distribution of free air conditioners to low-income vulnerable New Yorkers in years when we have money available for that program. So I'm going to focus on our heat syndromic surveillance, but I also just want to give you some background on our syndromic surveillance system in New York City. We have one of the oldest systems in the country, and it evolved out of the public health response to the September 11th, 2001 World Trade Center attacks. And it was initially designed to detect bioterrorism and outbreaks of a communicable disease. And today, de-identified chief complaint data is transmitted to our Bureau of Communicable Diseases on a daily basis from about 98% of the city's emergency departments. And we also get data on the previous day's EMS calls, as well as over-the-counter and prescription pharmacy sales daily. So the chief complaint field that comes along with this emergency department information has a short text description of why the patient has come to the hospital, and we use codes to search that text for what we call syndromes, or a collection of symptoms or words that indicate a particular type of disease. And over the years, the uses of this data has really expanded, and now there are many syndromes designed to track a variety of environmental and chronic conditions. In addition to heat illness, we also have some examples are we have an asthma syndrome, some syndromes for mental health conditions are under development, and we also use syndromic data to track some types of injuries. So the best indicator of risk for heat-related mortality and illness is definitely the weather forecast. We know when hot weather is most dangerous in our area because we've studied the past relationship of weather to mortality. And we use the heat illness syndrome to supplement our risk assessment based on the weather forecast during the heat wave. Syndromic surveillance can help give us situational awareness about the previous day's health impact during a heat emergency that extends for several days. As I mentioned, we monitor heat-related emergency department visits and EMS calls citywide. We use statistical models to help us detect increases in heat illness beyond what we might expect for the time of year and the weather conditions. And the results can be used, along with the weather forecast, to inform our citywide emergency response, which can be scaled up depending on the length and severity of the emergency. And it also helps us to shape public health messages. Our formal heat syndromic surveillance system was put into place in 2007. And in retrospective analyses, we first found that we could identify a small percentage of emergency department visits where the chief complaint suggested heat illness. And some EMS calls are assigned a heat call type by the dispatcher, so we could also track those. We found that these ED and EMS indicators of heat illness, although small in absolute numbers, were strongly associated with high temperatures. This graph shows heat stroke deaths and excess mortality in relation to the weather conditions and syndromic EMS calls and ED visits during the summer of 2006. And it also notes when the various types of data are available. So looking back, we saw that the peak in EMS calls and ED visits for heat-related illness preceded heat stroke deaths and the peak in natural cause mortality by a couple of days. Notification about heat stroke deaths can take sometimes days or weeks because there can sometimes be a lag between exposure and death, and because it can take some time for the medical examiner to investigate and certify deaths. It can also take weeks or months before complete data to look at excess natural cause mortality is available. But syndromic data on heat ED visits and EMS calls are available the next day, and it can be a good leading indicator of severe health impacts. And as I mentioned, we track EMS calls that are coded as heat-related. And for ED visits, we have an algorithm that searches a patient's chief complaint field for words that indicate heat stroke or other forms of heat illness. So, for example, fields with the word, with words like heat or hot are flagged, and our algorithm also captures a wide variety of misspellings and abbreviations. There are many exclusions also to ensure that the syndrome is pretty specific, since a lot of heat keywords can also potentially be used to describe other conditions. For example, if somebody chokes on a hot dog, which does happen, or spills hot liquids or coffee on themselves, they won't be included in the syndrome because we've excluded those words. So it's important to test your syndrome to make sure it's picking up what you want, and that will definitely help you identify real trends. And this can involve looking at line lists of heat syndrome records and looking at the association of heat syndrome counts with temperature. So during a heat wave, we have two statistical models to evaluate the health impact. Both of these models are time series models. And the first controls for time trends only, or what we call temporal trends, and that helps us answer the question, are we seeing more heat-related illness than expected given the time of year? And the second controls for time and meteorologic factors, so weather conditions. And this model would help us answer the question, are we seeing more heat-related illness than expected given the current weather conditions? And when there's a statistically significant deviation from what we'd expect, we say that we would say that the model is signaling. So the temporal model accounts for a number of different time trends, and it includes several years of data. Heat wave days in previous years are excluded, so the predicted values that it gives us are what we might expect for a non-heat wave or a normal summer day. And as I mentioned, it helps us determine whether we're seeing more heat-related illness than we'd expect given the time of year. And this is an example, the graph that you're seeing now is an example of one of our automated reports for emergency department data. It displays the daily maximum temperature or heat index, whichever is highest, in the blue and the purple lines at top. The observed counts of ED visits for heat are shown with the green crosses, and the expected counts from our model is shown with the black line. And signals on heat wave days are noted with red dots. And the weather model controls for both time variables and for meteorologic conditions. And signals from this model indicate during a heat wave that the amount of heat illness that we're seeing is in excess of what we'd expect for both the time of year and even the current hot weather conditions. So if you look at the expected counts shown at the bottom with the black line, you can see that the weather model does a pretty accurate job of predicting spikes in counts during hot weather. And this graph is from 2011 when we had a severe heat wave, and you can see that there was one day at the end of July where counts were much higher than would be predicted even for the very hot weather. Remember, though, that even if there's a lack of a signal, it doesn't mean that everything's okay. This model basically just tells us that the counts are rising in line with what we'd expect on a very hot day. So in terms of interpreting results during a heat wave, if there are no signals from either model, we're seeing the expected number of EMS calls and ED visits for the time of year. And it would be pretty unusual for neither type of model to signal during a significant heat wave. If there's a signal from the temporal model only, but not the weather model, we're seeing an increase in heat-related illness beyond expected for this time of year, which is associated with the really hot weather. If we see a signal from both models, we're seeing increases in heat illness beyond what's normal for the date, and a greater increase than expected even for the extremely hot weather. And this kind of information is really helpful for reinforcing our risk assessment guidance to senior leadership at our agency and others. And basically knowing that heat illness is elevated can be, and being able to say that with data behind it can be more persuasive sometimes than just saying that the weather forecast is concerning. In 2011, for example, we used this data to really push for and encourage enhanced communications and public statements from our Commissioner of Health and other public officials as the heat wave went on. So there are some limits and caveats with this type of surveillance to keep in mind. Heat syndromic counts are strongly associated with hot weather, but they're only a segment of the total emergency department and EMS call events, and they're a relative indicator of heat-related illness. So basically, they shouldn't be used to sort of quantify some sort of absolute impact or number of cases of heat illness. The data may not be complete. There's certainly the possibility for misclassification, meaning that some real cases are missed or that some are included in the syndrome that aren't really heat-related. There's also some variability in coding practices among hospitals, so some may have more standardized methods and others may be completely free-form, which can make it a little bit harder to pull out the cases that you want. However, the overall trends from this form of surveillance are very instructive, and increases in counts have been shown to happen during deadly heat waves. Another thing to keep in mind is that analyses to quantify some sort of an absolute impact of a heat wave can only be performed well after the event, when hospitalization and mortality data are relatively complete and available. And finally, this is an iterative process. We do tend to make small changes and improvements in our system every year. So just in conclusion, we do feel that syndromic surveillance data are a useful way to monitor heat illness in near real time during heat waves. It can provide health departments and other responders with information to guide prevention. And syndromic surveillance can be useful for monitoring population health during other climate emergencies. For instance, cold-related illness can be tracked during extreme winter weather or during a cold season power outage. Or carbon monoxide poisoning can also be tracked with syndromic surveillance during power outages and in extreme weather. So this is a valuable tool for environmental emergencies in general. And I just want to acknowledge the many people here at the Department of Health in New York City, both current and former, who have worked on the heat syndromic surveillance system, particularly Tom Matei and Christy Metzger, who originally designed and implemented the system. And I would like to thank the CDC's Climate Ready Cities and States Initiative. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Katie. That was fantastic. I will now introduce Katie Newhey. And she is with the Minnesota Climate and Health Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. She currently works at the program's as the communications coordinator with the program. Her responsibilities include developing and presenting training products and resources, as well as providing timely and accurate climate and health messaging to the media, also messaging to local public health and other partners. Prior to her position, she at MDH, she worked in public health emergency preparedness for the city of Bloomington in their public health division and the city of Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support. In 2010, she participated in the pilot testing and review of the CDC communications toolkit for extreme heat events. Katie.
Great. Thank you very much, Liz. My name is Katie Newhey. I'm the communications coordinator for the Minnesota Climate and Health Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm just going to give a really quick example of how a population very well versed in cold weather and snowstorm preparedness prepares for extreme heat. We will start this presentation with briefly looking at rising temperatures in Minnesota, look at some of our recent data on heat-related illness as provided by the Minnesota Environmental Public Health Tracking Program, and then discuss the strategies that we developed at the Minnesota Climate and Health Program. So there is a clear upward trend in temperature in Minnesota. This graph shows on the blue dotted lines Minnesota annual average temperature, which demonstrates a wide fluctuation in temperature from year to year. But the upward trend in temperature is indicated by the solid red line, which is a 10-year running average. Minnesota is the third fastest warming state since the 1970s. And we have seen some record heat in Minnesota, and in fact, six of the 15 warmest years in Minnesota have occurred since the year 2000. And the summer, last summer, we had an especially warm and dry season with record heat. And many of our record heat events are also driven by high dew points. A study showed that Minneapolis is expected to see 15 additional extreme heat days by the mid-century, though they currently have an average of about 8. And we will see an increase per summer average mortality in Minneapolis of 79, raising it from 14, which is the current number, to approximately 93 So a very concerning public health issue for us in Minnesota. So the heat-related illness data and graphics I'm going to share with you are developed in partnership with the Minnesota Environmental Public Health Tracking Program, and we've continued to work together in a very successful partnership that has been useful to share resources. We've used their data to inform our own recommendations and interventions, and we continue to work with them to coordinate some of our outreach efforts. The morbidity data comes from hospital admissions and emergency department visits for Minnesota residents, including those hospitalized in surrounding states of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. And that data comes from 2000 to 2010, which is our most current year available. And it also includes residents that have a primary or secondary diagnosis of heat illness based on ICD-9 codes. And then the mortality data comes from death certificates and Minnesota vital records. Just to sort of briefly talk about some of the challenges of our current data available, we know that these numbers are likely a vast underestimate of the overall heat burden because they only count those that are directly heat-induced illness or death, and we know that heat exacerbates other conditions, and those may not be coded. And then we also have some very small counts in certain years, especially of heat-related death, and it makes it very difficult for us to look at that data by the county level or to calculate rates due to cell suppression to protect data privacy. So the first graph that we're going to look at is heat-related illness hospitalizations graphed with the average summer temperature in Minnesota. So the blue line shows the average summer temperatures in May to September from 2000 to 2010, and the red line shows an age-adjusted hospitalization rate over that same time period. And we were interested but maybe not surprised to see that there was a pattern that suggested a relationship. And when we look at that data for emergency department visits, so now average temperature is indicated by the red line, and the age-adjusted rate for ED visits is indicated by the blue. Again, a very similar pattern to hospitalization. Interesting, but not surprising to us. Another set of interesting data to us, and actually a little bit surprising, was a regional breakdown between our metro area and our non-metro areas. And for Minnesota, the metro is defined as the areas of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then the seven surrounding counties. And non-metro is defined as all other counties in Minnesota. And typically, we expect to see maybe an increased rate in hospitalizations or an increased count for the urban population due to the urban heat island effect, but this graph and data suggests that the rural populations may be more at risk during periods of extreme heat, particularly as we look at 2001 and 2006. And our non-metro is represented by the green bars and graphs. So we see in those years that both the count and the rates were higher for the non-metro populations than the metro population. Actually see a very similar pattern for emergency department visits. So the non-metro indicated by the light blue and the metro indicated by the dark blue. Again, 2001, 2006, and 2010 standing out as being particularly severe for the non-metro population. The next that we're going to look at, a risk group that we're very interested in is AIDS. And when we looked at hospitalizations by age, we weren't surprised by this data. We know that very young children, that small bar represented by 0 to 4, and the elderly, that larger bar on the right, 65 years and older, we know that they're at an increased risk of heat-related illness. So this is for hospitalization, sort of a more long-term health impact. But what did surprise us was this emergency department visit data that actually shows that the population at greatest risk of emergency department visits are the 15 to 34-year-olds. And maybe not surprising as ED tends to capture some more acute visits and hospitalization more severe cases. And it might make sense that the younger and more active group or perhaps that this is a age group of people who are more likely to work outside or more likely to be active outside during heat events. But we were very interested to see this data. And the last slide that I have on some of our data is heat-related deaths annually in Minnesota, 2001 being a particularly bad year for mortality and morbidity, as we saw from the previous slide. This does show that the number of deaths directly attributed to heat stress are pretty rare, and we actually, like I said earlier, can't calculate rates because the count is so low. But we do expect that this is an underestimate of deaths where heat is a factor, and we are interested in looking at excess deaths to capture a true amount. But overall, what we've learned from this data is that we maybe need to focus some of our interventions and recommendations to groups that are outside of what we thought were our most at-risk populations, and that includes focusing on those non-metro areas, the more rural parts of our state, and also that age group, the 15 to 34-year-olds, and what we can do to prevent some of those emergency department visits amongst that population. So one of the things that we have done to prepare Minnesota for extreme heat is develop the Minnesota Extreme Heat Toolkit for local government agencies and public health professionals. And the goal of our toolkit is to prepare Minnesota for extreme heat events by increasing the number of jurisdictions in Minnesota that have planned for extreme heat and to ultimately reduce heat-related morbidity and mortality. The toolkit focuses on practical, implementable steps and strategies that are based on best practices. It includes an introduction to extreme heat events and Minnesota's warming trends, why extreme heat is a public health issue, and what the health impacts can be, and how to plan for those. Some of our specific tools available include draft language for heat response plans, data sources for mapping risk factors, and some sample communications materials. And one of the most important focus area of the toolkit is preparing Minnesota for extreme heat events, which is the topic of today's presentation. And we provide our toolkit users with the key steps to response, direction and plans for developing a response plan, and additional prevention strategies that they can consider, such as activating a heat information line, suspending utility shutoff during extreme heat events, and rescheduling or restructuring outdoor events. So I'm just going to take a moment to take a more in-depth look at the key steps to the response that we have developed. Number one over here on the left, the most important thing is to have a heat response plan that's developed before the extreme heat event even happens. And every community's response plan will be different. We respect that. We love working with local communities about what the response plan will look like for them. But we have identified some critical elements, which includes identifying your lead agency, some defined criteria for activating and deactivating a community's plan, some defined roles and activities for all agencies, a communications plan, the identification of vulnerable populations within the community, strategies for preventing heat-related illness or death, and an evaluation of the plan. And the second step is to predict a heat event using forecasts from the National Weather Service that include some important characteristics such as the high temps, the overnight lows, dew points, and duration of the heat event, so the number of days that that is expected to continue. And then the third step is to assess the risk based on that National Weather Service information, the predefined activation criteria, and then what we know about the potential health impacts. And that will determine whether or not the plan is activated. If the plan is activated, that's the fourth step. Public should be notified of the strategies that they can employ to stay cool, what resources are available to them, such as air-conditioned buildings that are open or cooling centers. Number five is to implement that response plan and make sure that all agencies are on board and prepared to respond to an extreme heat event. And then last but certainly not least is evaluation of that plan, talking about what went well, what did not go well, and the opportunities to improve, and the information learned from an evaluation after any event should inform sort of the next update of the plan, so it's always getting better. So the toolkit launched last year, April 2012, and since then we have had 958 views of the toolkit online, just of the base, which is the sort of five chapters of text and some instructions. But like I said, the toolkit also includes a whole host of appendices, sort of tools that and resources that local public health can use. And the total view of all components of our toolkit has been well over 3,000 views in the last year. So we're very excited that we know that this is getting out there. We know it's being used. Before the toolkit was developed, we knew that two jurisdictions had heat plans in Minnesota. Now we know that five have heat plans or annexes to their all-hazards plan, which cover a significant portion of the state. And in September, we facilitated a discussion amongst local public health departments to share their successes and challenges of planning for and responding to some extreme heat events that we had over the summer of 2012, which included an extreme heat event over the July 4th weekend, and what heat over a holiday, sort of how that messes up some plans sometimes. Another resource that we have made available is an extreme heat training module, and it is part of our climate change training module series. It's 1 hour, fully scripted, and intended for public health professionals to increase their awareness of the intersection of climate change, extreme heat, and public health. It provides strategies that health departments can use to protect their communities during an extreme heat event as well. And this is also available for download on our website. It was also launched last April and has received 526 online views or downloads. And so, again, this is another tool that we know is getting viewed, we know is being used in Minnesota. MDH has also developed a set of statewide maps of some selected risk factors to help local public health identify vulnerable populations in their communities and plan for how extreme heat events will impact those populations. And our maps include children less than five, the elderly 65 years and older, elderly living alone, and then also the population that lives at or below the poverty level and the population that lives at or below 200% of the poverty level. Any local public health or communities can access the maps and the data table that was used to create them on our website, and they can search for the data that they're interested in for their county and either compare it to neighboring counties, counties that are similar in size and demographics, or state-level data. In addition to our statewide map, we have provided technical assistance to five jurisdictions to map risk factors for heat-related illness specific to their community. Quantifying and mapping vulnerable populations and other risk factors provides really important information for planning and implementing the appropriate strategies that reach the most vulnerable populations of a community during a heat event. The maps featured on this slide are the City of Minneapolis, which were completed in 2011, and their maps focus on the elderly living alone, population in poverty, population without air conditioning, and the location of public air conditioning spaces, land cover, and more. Some other communities have chosen a variety of environmental characteristics mapped, which you can see on the slide, a lot of them focusing on where members of their community can access air conditioning if they don't have it themselves. In addition to developing our resources, we have worked very hard to promote heat-related illness prevention to both public health professionals and the general public. When the Minnesota Extreme Heat Toolkit was released, it was featured in several articles in medium and large newspapers in Minnesota, and that really helped promote our work, and it made us a lot more credible with the press when we later released health information before or during an extreme heat event. We have been really quick to release information about extreme heat when we anticipate an event, and we use press releases, social media, and email reminders to our climate and health listserv that local public health and community organizations should also share heat illness prevention tips. We do provide in our toolkit prevention tips for individuals that anybody can use, can download and use in their own outreach. So we're also working to provide training opportunities for local public health in Minnesota And we have currently provided training related to extreme heat events to our local public health association. We did a video conference training on the toolkit to over 20 sites with about 85 attendees that included local public health and local government. We have provided a training on how to find and use climate change and extreme heat data tools and resources to over 45 trainees. We've presented at numerous community health boards at their request and at the annual statewide community health conference. So we're really working very hard to get our message out and to make sure that heat stays on everyone's mind in Minnesota. Some of our ongoing challenges is continuing to update the tools as we get more information and updated climate data, including and adapting our materials and outreach as the concerns of local public health expand or change. And particularly, we've had a lot of concerns brought to us about the issue of extreme heat events and subsequent power outage, and especially as it relates to air conditioning being a great preventative measure until the power goes out and people lose access to air conditioning. Some of our communication challenges during actual extreme heat events have been sort of determining responsibility and coordination both within our agency and amongst other state agencies. And we don't want to cry wolf every time it gets warm in Minnesota, but we do want to provide accurate information that gives people enough time to change any of their behaviors that they need to stay cool, which may include rescheduling or modifying outdoor activities, finding an air-conditioned place to be during the hottest parts of the day, and so on. We did facilitate a syndromic surveillance work group in Minnesota, and we learned just a ton of information about where heat-related illness data might be collected as a person interacts with medical care, whether it's the 911 call information to hospitalization and death records. But right now, Minnesota doesn't have the resources or the political will to continue towards establishing a heat illness syndromic surveillance system. In the meantime, we are working with the Health Department of Arizona to facilitate a work group for other states and ourselves to learn about best practices for using syndromic surveillance for situational awareness for heat events, and perhaps so that we're prepared when people's interest grows in Minnesota and our resources become available. And that is all I have. All of our resources are available on our website, which you can see at the bottom of this slide. Everything is downloadable. And then on that website, you can also sign up for the Minnesota Climate and Health email listserv, which currently has over 500 subscribers that we're sharing our information with. So thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Katie. And thank you to all of our speakers today. That was really fantastic. And we've had a number of questions coming in from our almost 400 participants here, which is fantastic. And just to let folks know that the presentations are not available. There is some pre-publication data in some of these presentations, which you will be available, obviously, once the article is published. But this is information that is available on the CDC, the New York Department of Health website, for the most part. And as you heard from Katie, she gave you the website for the Minnesota information. So much of this information is available online, but the presentations will not be available. In addition, we will have, this is a recorded webinar, so you can come back and listen to it at a future date, and there will be a link to that circulated. So with that, I think we should go to some of our substantive questions here that have come in, and there are quite a few that are for Minnesota in particular, and I'm hoping that those folks can follow up with Katie for some specifics. But the ones that seem to be cross-cutting are, there was a question from Michael Schmelz who said, with all the coding that is being done to capture heat-related illnesses from EMS calls and ED visits, is there education or training being done on the physician side to better identify heat-related illnesses during diagnosis of patients during the heat waves? I just wonder if our speakers would like to touch upon that.
This is Catherine Lane. I can just tell you from our experience in New York City, we haven't done specific coding training for providers, but we do have a pretty extensive outreach program for providers. At the start of every heat season, we remind them about the dangers of heat waves and to be on the lookout for heat-related illness among their patients. And during heat waves, we also put out health alert network messages to them as well, basically giving the same reminders. So we do try to make sure that they're very conscious of the potential for heat-related illness among their patients, and that may help with identifying cases.
Great. Would anyone else like to answer that question, Dr. Luber or Katie Mihu?
I have nothing to add.
Okay.
We talked about that provider education sort of briefly during our surveillance meetings that we had, and we do know that some hospitals are doing it right now. We aren't necessarily actively providing education on heat-related illness, but it's something that we are interested in looking into as we continue to work on sort of surveillance work groups and how that would fit into a surveillance system if we got to that point.
Great. Okay, one other question from Elizabeth Miller is that in terms of coordination with the other states, so Minnesota and New York, coordinating within the region, and I thought also Dr. Luber could touch upon the incredible work going on throughout the country with the support of CDC on this. Could you describe that coordination on preparing for extreme heat events in terms of it sharing best practices?
Well, I guess I'll start. This is George. There's a number of ways in which we have been coordinating, and through various organizations have been facilitating that coordination. Several of you are aware of CSTE's work on indicators for climate change, and there's been some excellent work being done by the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists work group on climate change indicators that include not just assessing exposure risk, but also vulnerability metrics that have been operationalized into some mapping features. Perhaps one of the more interesting collaborations, and I'll let Minnesota elaborate on this more, is some cross-border work that has been done with our colleagues at Health Canada and the Manitoba Department of Health with Minnesota that has led to some very interesting exchange of ideas and information. And that has also extended to the city of Windsor that has collaborated with Detroit in their alerts as well. And we hope to expand the collaboration, the cross-border collaboration between Quebec and the Maritimes of provinces of Canada and our New England states to better help their efforts and their messaging. And I will let Minnesota elaborate more on their work.
Great. I want to thank Dr. Luber for really putting me on the spot because the Minnesota-Canada coordination is something that our director, Kristen Robb, works on quite extensively and much more than I do, so I think she is the most appropriate contact if someone is looking for more information about that. But I can just sort of give the 10,000-foot view, which is we certainly are always interested in working with the region, and it's been a very interesting process in working with Canada and sort of a similar climate and population to Minnesota's. And we really hope to get more ideas. And like Dr. Luber said, we've generated some great ideas out of that and how we can continue to collaborate, whether that is sharing resources, sharing information. I think it would be great if we could have some sort of regional common messages as a communications person. It really satisfies my needs that we're consistent across the region so that as people who live along our borders of our state are hearing consistent messages from media, whether that's North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, or Wisconsin. So we are continuing to sort of explore our regional coordination and then our cross-border collaboration with Canada as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Actually,
any other questions? Go ahead.
This is New York City also. I just wanted to mention, too, that just in terms of syndromic surveillance, we've exchanged our keywords with New Jersey and Maine and have a pretty close collaboration with New Jersey. And we, as part of the Climate Ready Cities and States Initiative, you know, there's some informal networks there for exchanging information, and we've begun to participate in the information sharing calls that Minnesota and Arizona have organized around heat syndromic surveillance. So those are some of the ways that we're exchanging best practices and collaborating.
Thank you very much, Katie. We do have a number of questions here, and I am conscious of the time that we seem we only have 2 minutes left. I want to double check with Angela to see if this line does close at 2:30.
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. Well, this has been wildly popular then, and I will just, why don't we do the final question. I'm going to try to see what I can do with the smattering of these questions. There were quite a few questions about power outages and power supply and the effect on the vulnerable communities like elderly and transient homeless populations. I wonder if one of you would like to take that, and then I would encourage everyone who has specific questions to follow up with the individual speakers as well.
This is Katie from...
Oh, go ahead.
Katie from Minnesota, and I think I'll at least take a stab at what Minnesota is sort of doing or hearing, because I did bring it up in my presentation, and what we have heard from local public health, particularly through that little discussion that we had with them back in September, and then in some presentations is, so we are recommending help people find air conditioning, encourage people to you know, visit friends or family with air conditioning. And then they're saying, well, what if the power goes out? We're in a lot of trouble. And we actually know there's a lot of other health concerns related to power outage, which can be, you know, not just air conditioning, but food and water storage, water treatment, medical devices and medical vaccination storage, medication storage that requires refrigeration. It's on our radar to really talk about power outage and what can be done. We haven't started that work, but we are certainly listening to our local public health partners that say that this is a major concern for them. We know one county experienced this problem last summer where their plans sort of didn't disintegrate, but they ran into quite a few hiccups because a lot of their heat planning was based on air conditioning and power, and then they lost power for a significant part of their jurisdiction and had to sort of work around that with getting rapidly deployed generators and things like that. I think they did an excellent job preparing for that and responding to sort of that extra challenge, but it is something that we are going to continue to explore in the next, you know, maybe a little bit this summer and certainly as we continue our work.
And this is Catherine in New York City. I also just wanted to say that that's definitely on our radar for sure. And we take several steps to prevent a power outage during a heat wave. Some of the things that one thing that we do is an excavation safety alert when we know that extreme heat is coming, which urges contractors to use extreme care when they're digging to ensure that underground power and communication systems aren't compromised during a heat wave. And Con Edison, our power company, is part of our citywide heat emergency response group. And this is definitely something just in general that we're aware of and concerned about, too. And also, one last thing to mention is that we definitely do homeless outreach during extreme heat events to try and get people off the street, because I think that somebody had asked about that as well. So thank you.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank so much the speakers today. This was a fantastic webinar. And would anyone else like to make one closing statement? I know we're right up against the end of the hour.
Hi, this is George. I'd just like to thank APHA and for all of those who joined the webinar today. I hope this provides useful. If you would, please let us know how this went, if you'd like some different information next time, and we'll hope to be able to provide that. So thank you again.
Thank you so much, George. Thanks to all of you, and please follow up with all of your great questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your webinar for today. We do thank you again for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.